You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Kingdom of Prep by Maggie Bullock. Of course, these non-catalog models needed clothes to sell. Let's rewind back to 1984. For its first couple of years, J. Crew had no design team. Merchants ordered mostly existing standards from private label manufacturers, customized the color, or maybe the buttons, and slapped a J. Crew label on them. Nothing to sniff at. This was standard operating procedure for many smaller companies. Emily elevated the product range as best she could, mostly by bringing in things to copy, sometimes as an outright knockoff, more often to match a hue or mimic a detail. Emily's finds would be shipped off to a faraway factory and return as J. Crew product. But the copycat game can get dicey. One early designer recalled that Emily was eventually banned from Ralph Lauren's Manhattan store. They figured out exactly what she was up to there. Emily flatly denies having been banned. Another early staffer recalls an inspo trip to Barney's. The woman filled her arms with several thousand dollars worth of men's zillion-ply cashmere sweaters, carried them up to the register, and handed over her corporate card. The company name on it read Popular Services Incorporated. The salesperson did a double take, from the card back to the fresh-faced woman wielding it. "What is Popular Services?" "Oh, it's an escort service," blurted the staffer, surprising even herself. "I'm doing the Christmas shopping." J. Crew had always planned on hiring its own design team once the company got its sea legs. Maybe this was a sign the time had come. In 1985, Emily hired designer Linda Snyder, installed her in an office right next to her own, and tasked her with setting up the company's first sample room, ordering sewing machines, steamers, pattern tables, dress forms. But Snyder couldn't wait for these supplies to arrive. One Saturday morning, she came into work, along with her assistant from her former job. Snyder brought her own sewing machine, a pair of sawhorses borrowed from her dad, and a drill. The two women unscrewed the hinges on a stockroom door, set it up on the sawhorses to make a cutting table, and started marking a pattern. "By the end of the day," she says, "we had made J. Crew's first proprietary sample." Little by little, a real design team began to take root. At a cocktail party, Horn spotted a dapper young Southerner named Sid Mashburn. Mashburn was the 24-year-old husband of Ann Mashburn, a chic friend from Horn's Vogue days. In Horn's estimation, he possessed immaculate men's style. J-press, Oxford cloth shirts, sharp khakis. "My filter was always, would my dad wear it? Or would I date a guy who would wear it?" she says. Soon, designer Claire McDougald was hired to develop knits. Lisa Anastasi made the leap from Ralph Lauren to oversee sweaters. The little design team commuted to Garfield every morning the way city kids get to summer camp. A company van would pick them up on a corner in Manhattan and deposit them in New Jersey. This arrangement, though deeply unstylish, had its upsides. No late nights. If you missed the bus when it came back at the end of the day, you were screwed. The exception, Emily and Horn often left the office at 11 p.m., driving back to the city in Emily's serviceable second-hand Volkswagen Scirocco. Not one of them was over the age of 27, and most had only a few years' experience, some barely any at all. The core team churned out a handful of designs that, for a certain generation of believers, still define J. Crew. The thinking behind these garments was not grand or conceptual, but deeply pragmatic. These were things the designers longed for in their own closets, the kind of items that you go out shopping and expect to find but never can, recalls Horn. They don't quite exist. You never knew where you were going to stumble on that one perfect thing. Horn remembers walking into the office one day when Emily stopped her in her tracks. "Let me feel your pants," she commanded. They were Army-Navy pants, but better, from the French company Chevignon. It had taken Horn years to properly break these pants in, achieving a hand feel that to Emily was the Holy Grail. "This is what we have to do," Emily said. As Horn tells it, she handed over her favorite pants, and Emily took out a big pair of shears and sliced off a piece of the fabric. It would be sent to a factory that would replicate the wash. Horn stood there, mouth hanging open. But what was she going to do? Tell Emily no? That did not happen. Some of J. Crew's greatest hits were relatively subtle improvements on existing items from the canon. Carhartt had its classic engineer sack coat. L.L. Bean had its barn coat. Both bore a strong resemblance to J. Crew's barn jacket. To design the original, Mashburn inspected an armful of vintage hunting and field jackets and devised a drop shoulder shape that was appropriately 80s boxy, added a plaid flannel lining, and sourced a canvas that was a bit more forgiving than the stiff stuff real hunting jackets were made of. The end product looked like something that had been hanging in a family cabin for decades. The beloved J. Crew anorak was based on one of Arthur Senator's old sailing jackets, a pullover style Emily remembered him wearing when she was a kid. The roll-neck sweater, a multi-million-dollar item, and, to my mind at least, the brand's most iconic, was also Emily's idea, inspired by an old woolen pullover that an ex-boyfriend had inherited from his grandfather. It was so well worn, it was unraveling at the neck. "There aren't a lot of ways to reinvent the sweater," says knitwear designer Anastasi, "but the roll neck did just that, if quietly. It was made without the ribbed trim that usually finishes the hem and neck of a sweater, which allowed the edges to roll up naturally. The J. Crew roll neck was initially a men's sweater, but as the popular girls at private schools everywhere would soon discover, this made it alluringly oversized, just right for pulling over one's hands on a chilly day. The first time, Emily was certain J. Crew 2.0, her J. Crew, was a bona fide hit, was because of a photo of Jane Gill. Yes, the star of countless Ralph Lauren campaigns. In the photo, Gill wears nothing more elaborate than a t-shirt in palest pink. Her smile is partially shaded by a wide Stetson, and of course there's a tiny Jack Russell nestled in her arms. It's a pretty picture, but no more so than 1,000 other J. Crew pictures. So maybe Gill had a special power. Or maybe the formula they'd been tinkering with, aspirational, relatable, comfortable, American, had finally struck gold. Whatever the reason, that photo did what today we would call breaking the internet. Emily had gone into the season betting big on the t-shirt style Gill was wearing, ordering 5,000 of them, which for J. Crew was a huge number. 80,000 orders poured in. J. Crew went into overdrive. Someone was dispatched on a plane to a factory. More now. In the years to come, Emily's J. Crew would morph into version 3.0, then 4.0, moving with the times as any successful retailer must, but also with Emily herself. When Emily was in her post-college phase, J. Crew churned out chinos and sweaters. As she matured, so did J. Crew, staking its claim on the 9-to-5 wardrobe. And when, in a twist nobody saw coming, Emily headed to Hollywood, J. Crew did too, albeit in its own tastefully subdued East Coast way, naturally. It was Bruce Willis who talked Emily into making boxer briefs. Chris O'Donnell told her J. Crew ought to make a tuxedo. they did. When Deschan Thurman modeled for the catalog barefoot in a red union suit on a snowy dock floating on an ice-cold lake, J. Crew had a car standing by, ready to whisk him off to the Academy Awards to witness the Oscar moment of Big Sister Uma, another new Emily friend. Back in the company's whitewashed Chelsea loft space, by the dawn of the 90s they had upgraded to more suitable digs, Julia Roberts dropped by one day to say hi. She happened to show up on a day there was a fire drill. She was very nice about it. What the hell was going on here? It was fairly simple, really. Emily was now half of a Hollywood fashion power couple. In 1991, she wed her first husband, producer Cary Woods. He would have a hand in some of the edgiest, most zeitgeisty fare of the decade, Harmony Korine and Larry Clark's raw New York City skate rat flick Kids, horror juggernaut Scream, Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau's star-making spin in Swingers. As far as anyone back in J. Crew's New York headquarters, which by 1991 included a promising new hire, young Parsons grad Jenna Lyons, could tell, their buttoned-up Emily was hanging behind the scenes in a new milieu and sprinkling valuable fairy dust on the brand. Emily never quite seemed to find her tribe in New York, perhaps because from the age of 21 she'd been up to her ears in the running of J. Crew. But now she was attending screenings of the Woods-produced football movie Rudy at the Clinton White House. Occasionally she let slip, in a way that didn't always seem inadvertent, that she'd been at Brad Pitt's pool that weekend. To the J. Crew originators who had populated Emily's early photo and design teams, who for years humbly boarded a van to get to work and toiled under the fluorescent lights of Popular Club Plan's former appliance store offices, people for whom, to put it mildly, working at J. Crew had been anything but glamorous, watching their little catalog company become vaguely hip, mind-blowing. But then, these people would not have put anything past Emily. Today, they look back at Emily through a lens informed by the 2020s. This woman who was so young, with no prior experience, and in a rare position of authority. If she were building J. Crew today, Emily would indubitably have been saddled with that albatross girl boss. For years, as J. Crew doubled and then tripled in size, Emily's team, who age-wise at least were her peers, saw a woman supremely sure of herself and of her decisions, who appeared undaunted, tireless, who, yes, could be condescending and brusque in her delivery, who was strict, hyper-particular, and suffered no fools. But to many of the core team that stuck with her for years, Emily's prickliness was not just a cost of doing business at J. Crew. It was a key ingredient in the brand's secret sauce. Emily's relentless eagle eye for every detail was the force that kept a brand that sold basics from tumbling into the pit of blah. Emily never allowed this team to see the pressure she was under or its possible toll on her. Indeed, Emily did not allow them to see much of anything. From day one, her interior life was a mystery to one and all. But sometimes they could feel it. When Emily was on set and the models took a break, you could almost hear her mentally calculating the dollars and cents of every lost minute, ka-ching, ka-ching, waiting for them to get back to work. This was not particularly conducive to the happy-go-lucky realness J. Crew demanded from its photographers. Once, an elaborate shoot was planned at a ranch in Jackson Hole. They hauled an army of models, the photographer, stylist, and assistants out west, but somewhere along the way, a connecting flight never arrived. They had to rent a U-Haul, load in clothes, props, and lighting and photography equipment, and drive the rest of the way. The crew didn't get to the ranch until 8 a.m. the following day, bleary-eyed and desperate for sleep. But when they phoned New York to check in, Emily's orders were unequivocal. Get to work. From the book, The Kingdom of Prep, The Inside Story of the Rise and Near Fall of J. Crew by Maggie Bullock. Copyright 2023 by Maggie Bullock. Excerpted by permission of Dye Street Books, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Past is present. half a century ago amid Supreme Court hearings on Roe v. Wade, racial reckonings, and political tension, a group of women launched Ms. Magazine. Here, Gloria Steinem reflects on that first year by Keziah Weir. Opening photo, Gloria Steinem at a staff meeting for Ms. Magazine in New York City in 1975. Other photos. Today, Ms. is published quarterly by the Feminist Majority Foundation. Steinem at her desk. Steinem at her home office. Steinem with freelance designer Barbara Krauss, a whiz with the X-Acto knife. Staff portrait in 1972. Steinem, Ronnie Eldridge, and Ms. co-founder Patricia Carbine, circa 1970. To hear Gloria Steinem describe the Ms. Magazine office during its inaugural year of 1972 calls to mind a feminist worker's utopia. The editorial team conducted meetings in a talking circle, passing a stick to indicate who was speaking. Salaries were need-based. When not in the tot lot, the art director's five-year-old delivered mail via tricycle. 50 years later, to flip through the magazine's first year is to fall into something of a time warp. I didn't anticipate then, says Steinem, that I would be here at age 88, confronting not exactly the same versions of issues, but the same kinds of issues. Child care, pay equality, mass incarceration. Angela Davis on the importance of writing for, about, and black women. Cynthia Ozick on the absurdity of defining a person by their organs. If anatomy were destiny, the wheel could not have been invented. We would have been limited by legs. And abortion. To many American women and men, it seems absurd in this allegedly enlightened age that we should still be arguing for a simple principle. That a woman has the right to sovereignty over her own body, reads a call to action signed by 53 women, including Dorothy Pittman Hughes, Billie Jean King, and Nora Ephron. It ran in the 1972 preview issue, released a year before the Roe v. Wade decision. Of today's debate over inclusive language, you could just say people with wombs, Steinem says. It doesn't need to be complicated. As in the pursuit of any nuanced cause, factions were nearly inevitable. Radical feminist Vivian Gornick would part ways with the magazine early on over philosophical differences. In the mid-80s, Alice Walker would resign, citing an unrealized desire for more people of color on the cover. Gornick would remain a Ms. defender, and Walker a friend of Steinem's. There was always a consciousness that we were trying to do something that hadn't been done, Steinem says of that time, however imperfectly we'd be doing it. In more photos, cover to cover, Ms. Magazine spreads from its inaugural year, including the spring 1972 We Have Had Abortions campaign, a reevaluation of Wonder Woman in July 1972, and Alice Walker's short story Rose Lily, which appeared in August 1972 and would go on to open her debut collection in Love and Trouble, Stories of Black Women, the following year. Thank you. the Queen Mother. The question of reparations couldn't be more urgent. As the health care crisis for Black Americans worsens, in Queen Mother, Audley Moore, we have a newly relevant template for change, by A. Kirsten Mullen, with opening painting by Charlie Palmer. Something that is often missing from reparations talk, legal scholar Alfred Brophy observed in 2010, is a specific plan for repairing past tragedies. California and New York have joined the dozen or so states and municipalities that have initiated what they are calling reparations programs. As a core platform issue, presidential candidate Marianne Williamson proposed up to $500 billion in payments to the descendants of U.S. slavery, but even that was woefully inadequate. Enslaved Africans were the first abolitionists, seizing every possible moment to liberate themselves and their families, and they were the first architects of reparations. Other groups in the U.S. have developed successful redress strategies. Holocaust victims, Japanese Americans unjustly incarcerated during World War II, 9/11 victims, the Iran hostages, victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, and many others. But Black American descendants of U.S. slavery have come up empty-handed. The racial wealth gap is the most robust indicator of the cumulative economic effects of white supremacy in the United States. It is, on average, about $850,000 per Black household, for a total of $14 trillion. The annual budgets of all 50 states and every municipality in the country combined is about $4.68 trillion. Only the federal government has the capacity to pay the bill, and a sufficient proportion of white Americans must support doing so. Qualitative profiles, stories, and narratives capture people emotionally, but they often are dismissed as purely anecdotal. Numbers establish patterns that can be generalized to a larger group. Black nationalist Queen Mother Audley Moore understood the importance of documenting racial disparities, and she believed in taking complaints to a higher authority. In 1957, the Black Power pioneer presented a petition to the United Nations demanding land for Black Americans and billions of dollars in reparations. And in 1963, she launched the Committee for Reparations for Descendants of U.S. Slaves. Pan-Africanists invoke Moore's name because she also embraced decolonization and freedom for Africa and believed the federal government should provide funds to Black Americans who wanted to repatriate to the continent. Moore appears to be consistent in arguing that reparations from the U.S. government should go to Blacks whose ancestors were enslaved here and not to Blacks who migrated here after slavery ended, particularly the large number who came after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Several of her more vocal disciples, however, have used her ideological pan-Africanism to put words in Moore's mouth, ones that support the claim that U.S. reparations should go to all people of African descent. Equal parts oracle, badass, and political strategist, Moore and her collaborators launched the campaign to demand reparations in New Orleans in 1955, after concluding it was the only way to save our people from execution. She was not the first person to endorse a national reparations program for Black American descendants of U.S. slaves. That distinction goes to Callie Guy House, who was born into slavery around 1861 in Rutherford County, near Nashville. As her biographer, Mary Frances Berry, documents, in My Face is Black is True, Callie House and the Struggle for Ex-Slave Reparations, House tirelessly petitioned the U.S. government for pensions, a form of reparations for the 1.9 million people formerly enslaved, including the more than 180,000 black soldiers who fought in the Union Army during the Civil War. White veterans received pensions from the federal government, House observed. Why not blacks? Moore was born in New Iberia, Louisiana, at the tail end of Reconstruction in 1898. The same year, House co-founded the National Ex-Slave Mutual Relief, Bounty and Pension Association. Moore's mother, Ella Henry, had been educated in France after a wealthy white family chose Henry as their daughter's companion. Better a black child they could control than the poor whites whom they despised. But Henry died in childbirth when Moore was 5 years old. Her father, Sincere Moore, an assistant deputy sheriff who had been run out of a nearby town for retaliating in kind against a white neighbor who had horsewhipped his young son, would die before Moore reached adolescence. Sincere's mother was the daughter of an enslaved woman and the white plantation man who had raped her, and Henry's father had been lynched trying to protect his land. When Moore was very young, around the time her mother died, she witnessed a lynching in New Iberia. I remember the hollering, white men like wolves, and the black man's feet was tied behind the wagon, and he passed in front of our house, she said. His head was bumping up and down on the clay on the hard, crusty road. Moore's lived experience would define her trajectory. An organizational zealot, Moore was a member of the Communist, Republican, and Democratic parties, as well as, she said, the Elks and the Masons. She was a Catholic, an ordained bishop, and a convert to the Baptist and Ethiopian Orthodox communities of faith, and the Apostolic Orthodox Church of Judah. I've got all the religions, she said years later. I have one objective, win 'em for freedom. One might wonder if she ever worked for the FBI, which built a copious file on Moore over a 20-year period. Apparently, the agency did approach her in the 1940s to become an informant. Her account of what took place. I'll tell you the truth. When I am in my right mind, I could join the Ku Klux Klan and know why I'm there, you understand? I could join the police force if I had to. In 1919, during the Red Summer, white terrorists launched upwards of 40 attacks on black communities. The heroic military service of more than 380,000 blacks during World War I had not brought an end to disenfranchisement and segregation, debt peonage, and racial violence. White supremacy at home proved to be a more invincible foe than the German army. Blacks in Louisiana and elsewhere were desperate to see an end to the carnage and the destruction of black property. But they did not have the capacity to make this happen. Marcus Garvey believed the solution lay with blacks themselves. Like his hero, Booker T. Washington, he embraced respectability politics. Blacks must accept responsibility for improving themselves to show white Americans they are worthy of equal rights. First, though, they must accept and celebrate their African past and be proud of their black skin. The next year, 1920, Garvey was scheduled to speak in New Orleans, but was arrested. When he was released the following day, he returned to the Longshoremen Hall to bring his message of Africa for Africans and back to Africa, the place where all black people could be proud, unified, and self-sufficient. The police, on alert to arrest him again at the least provocation, had not counted on the crowd arriving armed to the teeth, ready to defend Garvey, Moore, and her family among them. The police withdrew. The Moores briefly contemplated moving to Africa, but decided to relocate to Harlem instead. First, they took a month-long trip to Los Angeles, where Moore met several women in what was called Black Society, who took her to Santa Monica, where they wanted to charge us $5 for a bottle of 5-cent soda. She became disillusioned until all the people there said, "Oh, my dear, if it's freedom you're looking for, we could have told you we have discrimination in California. Where you should have gone was Chicago." So the Moors traveled to Chicago, where they found conditions worse than in New Orleans. "Oh," they said, "my dear, it's not here. Harlem's where you need to go." Now, I didn't realize Harlem, too, was Jim Crow. No blacks were hired as bus or streetcar drivers, and no one could find a job in their own neighborhood. Black women stood on the street corners, and the Jewish women used to come, almost just like slavery days, feel their muscles, look at their knees to see if they had crust on their knees, evidence that they could get on their knees to wax their floors, she recalled years later. That was when Moore committed herself to the movement. After Garvey was indicted on mail fraud charges in 1922 and deported to Jamaica in 1927, Moore turned her attention to the work that would lead to what historian Ashley D. Farmer, who is writing a biography of Moore, calls her pioneering role in forging the modern reparations movement. With the support of her sister Eloise, whom Moore called the family's Socrates, brilliant, analytical, she began to organize her neighbors in their mutual struggle for survival and decency. Throughout the Great Depression, Moore and her fellow reformers were engaged in great struggle. Already relegated to the lowest-paying professions, blacks experienced an unemployment rate of approximately 50% in 1932 New York. When the U.S. Communist Party made the unlikely decision to champion the cause of the Scottsboro Boys, nine black youths who had been falsely accused of raping two white women in Alabama, Moore eagerly offered her services. She would serve the party as secretary of its Harlem section in 1941. And secretary of the New York State Party in 1942. Moore managed the successful campaign of New York City's first avowed black communist city council member, Benjamin Jefferson Davis, Jr., in 1943. In later years, Moore took pains to give the party its due for getting black doctors and nurses into hospitals. But there were problems. Apart from Harlem section head James W. Ford, whose grandfather had been lynched, burned alive when Ford was young, and who was the party's vice presidential nominee in 1932, 1936, and 1940, the New York chapter leadership was Lily White. And while other national commissions were given the authority to meet separately, Italians, Jews, Romanians, Estonians, Finns, the Negro Commission had white members. When Moore realized they had no intention of working with blacks as equal partners, her admiration turned to frustration. She resigned in 1950, later recalling, "Racist by the score, racist, full of racism." Over this time, Mary McLeod Bethune had recruited Moore to the National Council of Negro Women, which had a reputation as a less militant organization. By 1944, Moore was a member of its executive board, working on integration and housing discrimination and defeating poll tax legislation. Moore made 10 trips to Europe in 1946 to escort war brides and their infants who had been left behind by American GIs to the U.S. During her nearly two-year stint in the Army Civilian Corps, she worked for and escorted 7,000 to 8,000 brides of every nationality, except German, to America. In an interview she gave to the Chicago Defender in January 1947, Moore marveled at the women's lack of race prejudice, noting that one woman has married a Brooklyn GI, and already she knows that the Statue of Liberty means more to her than to me, a Negro, who brought her here. The 1950s seemed to be the decade of Moore's full flowering, the point where her vision expanded to a desire for freedom for Africans everywhere, at home and abroad. In 1954, Moore's brother died, so she returned to Louisiana and was reunited with the sons and daughters of Ethiopia, which had grown out of Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association. Several years later, she drew together her base in Louisiana and in her adopted home of Harlem to found the Universal, after Garvey's UNIA Association of Ethiopian Women, with, among others, her sisters Eloise and Loretta, to decrease the number of executions of our youth on challenges of rape of white women. Moore viewed white supremacy, Jim Crow segregation and terror, political persecution, the oppression of black womanhood, colonialism, lynching, and black poverty as forms of genocide. These practices, she believed, represented a violation of universal, inalienable human freedoms, such as freedom of conscience, the right of self-determination, protected under the United Nations Human Rights Declarations, and ultimately the right to life. In 1963, in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, Moore launched and led the Committee for Reparations for Descendants of U.S. Slaves. The group published her treatise, Why Reparations? Reparations is the battle cry for the economic and social freedom of more than 25 million descendants of American slaves. 5 years later, in 1968, she named, co-founded, and developed the concept for the Black Nationalist Republic of New Africa. Members demanded self-determination, land, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, and parts of Texas and Florida, and funding from the U.S. government. Moore was at the height of her powers during the decolonization of Africa and began to promote repatriation, making more than a dozen trips to the continent. In 1972, when she was invited to attend the Organization of African Unity, the old chief in Ghana sent for her so he could initiate me. The chief showered her with gobs of gold, jewels, bracelets of gold, rings, and ropes of gold around my neck, and a crown. He got the stool and the umbrella and initiated me Queen Mother of the Ashanti. She would use her platform with the Philadelphia-based National Emancipation Proclamation Centennial Observance Committee to push this Africa for Africans agenda, one she would elaborate upon continuously until she died in 1997. In her later years, Moore consented to a 1978 life review with Cheryl Townsend Gilkes, conducted for the Black Women Oral History Project, and her son, Thomas O. Warner, whom she called her prince, wrote about his famous mother. Many of the atrocities Moore worked to address have not been eradicated. She would not be surprised to learn of the enormous suffering of Black Americans during the COVID pandemic. Nationwide, at this writing, 146,108 Blacks have died from COVID-19, a mortality rate 1.7 times that of whites, and twice the rate of Asians. The Black mortality rate is 457 per 100,000. In November 2020, when the death rate peaked, Blacks and Hispanics and American Indians or Alaska Natives were nearly four times as likely to die from COVID as whites. What would these numbers have looked like if Black Americans had received reparations before the onset of the virus in 2015, say, or 2010? In an experiment led by Eugene T. Richardson and James Holland Jones that was designed to look at racial justice interventions, scholars examined the social equity status of two disparate locations, South Korea and Louisiana, Moore's home state. They found there would have been a reduction in the ability of the disease to spread of 31% to 68%. That positive health effect would have been realized by blacks and distributed across all racial groups, benefiting the population at large. In 1994, when she was 96 years old, Queen Mother Audley Moore addressed a conference in Detroit. "Reparations, reparations," the legend urged her audience. "Keep on, keep on. We've got to win." The aftermath. Girls have been banned from school after sixth grade. Women are mandated to be fully covered except for their eyes. Female employment has virtually disappeared. Peter Van Ockmail reports in photographs from Afghanistan, where the Taliban have spent the past year erasing women from public life. Opening photo, One Nation Under Men, members of the Taliban in Kabul's Wazir Akbar Khan Park at sunset. In August 2021, after U.S. forces had hastily departed Afghanistan, the leaders of the Taliban held their first press conference since completing the conquest of the country. For the first time in years, it seemed the world's attention was focused on the war-torn nation. In a break with the past, the Taliban spokesman vowed to honor women's rights within our framework of Sharia law. A Taliban official agreed to be interviewed by a female TV journalist. This apparently conciliatory attitude came as a surprise to many, given the lack of guarantees for women's rights in the fine print of the peace deal that the U.S. and the Taliban had negotiated the year before. Many hoped that the more moderate elements of the Taliban would now be dictating policy, and that the hard-fought gains over the previous 20 years would be at least partially upheld. The months that followed dashed these expectations. On a recent trip to Afghanistan, it was clear to me that the erasure of women from public life is well underway. Edicts have been passed banning girls from school after the sixth grade. Women are now mandated to be fully covered except for their eyes. Female employment has virtually disappeared, though women still work as doctors and surgeons. Without them, the hospitals would not be able to keep up with demand. True, in rural Afghanistan, where nearly 80% of the population resides, women had seen little progress for decades, despite the meaningful strides their counterparts had experienced in urban centers. Such advances, however, have largely disappeared in over the past year. Throughout Afghanistan, vinyl banners appear on the streets ordering women to keep cloaked and forbidding them to leave homes without a male escort. Vice and virtue squads have begun patrols. Women TV presenters, who at first had continued to show their faces, have been forced to be fully veiled. At one point, some of their male colleagues staged a futile protest, donning surgical masks for the evening newscast. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.